This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by Talking Politics at the Dinner Table. Talking Politics at the Dinner Table. Don't! Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is about politics in Anne of Green Gables. I hope you've been enjoying my series on Anne of Green Gables as a work of historical fiction. While Lucy Maud Montgomery published this novel in 1908, it's actually set in the 1880s. I've previously discussed the fashion, music, and poetry of this period, but now we're going to go into things outside teen culture and move into politics and religion. The teenagers who read Anne of Green Gables when it first came out would have gotten a nostalgic window into the culture of their parents' teen years, including a bit of the politics of the period. This story is set on Prince Edward Island, which was, and still is, Canada's smallest province, both geographically and by population. It would be easy to think that modern readers couldn't really relate to the politics of 19th century Canada, but this isn't so. Political parties might change, but some things don't, like the experiences teenagers have as they become more aware of the world, or the perpetual tension between conservative and progressive political movements. I deliberately avoid talking about modern-day politics on this show. I usually find it depressing, divisive, and just unrelated to my ideas about children's literature, but in the case of Anne of Green Gables, there are some really interesting moments in the book that do have to do with politics. I made a really pleasant discovery when researching the politics in Anne of Green Gables, and that's that, despite a huge variety of opinion, the characters all seem to get along with one another and respect each other despite major differences. This is probably because, in the 1880s, there were only about 100,000 people on Prince Edward Island, and the island itself is very, very small. You couldn't afford to alienate anyone. You couldn't afford to just not speak to someone. You had to mix with everyone, regardless of your opinions or how you felt about things. And so it seemed that this encouraged people to be just a little more tolerant and patient, and that you were allowed to have strongly felt feelings, but that didn't affect your ability to have friendships with people, even if they didn't feel the same as you. Mrs. Rachel Lynde is an opinionated loudmouth. Marilla Cuthbert is equally opinionated, but tightly reserved in the way she expresses herself. And yet, the two women are good friends who respect one another. Anne's classmates at the Avonlea School are divided between the two major political parties, but that doesn't stop them from having a great time together. This is a lesson I think we could all benefit from today. Even now, Prince Edward Island only has a population of about 150,000, and I wonder if things have changed. Do people still have to live and let live and get along because you can't avoid seeing one another? Or has the internet allowed people to kind of retreat into their own little camps the way it has in so many other places? So, what politics do we find in Anne of Green Gables? Well, not too many, and when it does come up, it's a very natural part of the story, just kind of eased into conversation the way it would be in real life. In Chapter 15, Anne comes home from school and declares that she will not go back. Instead, she'll learn her lessons at home. This doesn't come as a huge surprise to Marilla. The teacher, Mr. Phillips, is unreasonable, unprofessional, commands no respect from his students, and doesn't produce good academic results. Lucy Maud Montgomery was a schoolteacher herself on Prince Edward Island, and the character of Mr. Phillips is based on her firsthand observation of colleagues who had no business being in a school. Marilla realizes that forcing Anne to go back to school will just backfire. So she goes next door to consult with her neighbor, Mrs. Rachel Lynde, a woman who's had 12 children and managed to raise 10 of them to adulthood, a pretty impressive feat in the 19th century. Rachel has plenty of expertise when it comes to education and teenagers. She gives a speech that condemns nepotism, messy small-town politics, and even hints at the fact that, at this point in history, women were excluded from holding political office. To Marilla's amazement, Rachel advises her to humor Anne and homeschool her for a while. "Then you really think I'd better let her stay home?" said Marilla in amazement. "Yes. That is, I wouldn't say school to her again until she said it herself. Depend upon it, Marilla, she'll cool off in a week or so and be ready enough to go back of her own accord, that's what. While if you were to make her go back right off, dear knows what freak or tantrum she'd take next and make more trouble than ever. The less fuss made, the better, in my opinion. She won't miss much by not going to school, as far as that goes. Mr. Phillips isn't any good at all as a teacher. The order he keeps is scandalous, that's what, and he neglects the young fry and puts all his time on those big scholars he's getting ready for Queen's. He'd never have got the school for another year if his uncle hadn't been a trustee. The trustee, for he just leads the other two around by the nose, that's what. I declare I don't know what education in this island is coming to." Mrs. Rachel shook her head, as much to say if she were only at the head of the educational system of the province, things would be much better managed. That last bit isn't a jab at Rachel. Sure, it's amusing because she has strong opinions and a very high opinion of herself, but everything she said is true. She's also subtly asking the question, why can't a woman be in charge of education on Prince Edward Island? When Anne of Green Gables was published, Canadian women still didn't have the right to vote, and they were still excluded from numerous professions and posts in government. By including Rachel's opinions in this passage, Montgomery was reminding her young readers and their parents that the battle for women's equal rights had been going for a long time and still had not been won. Another thing this passage touches on is Anne studying at home, although I don't think modern readers should try to connect this with modern political issues around homeschooling and school choice. In the 1880s, education was not universal or compulsory, and only about half of kids attended school at all. It was really common for kids to learn at home, and pulling your child out of a neighborhood school to study at home would not have been a choice that had anything to do with politics or ideology. It does show, though, that in this culture, it was considered normal for parents to have total control over their children's education, and nobody would have imagined that the government would have had anything to say about when, where, and how a child should be educated. The next time politics are mentioned is in Chapter 18. All things great are wound up with all things little. At first glance, it might not seem that the decision of a certain Canadian premier to include Prince Edward Island in a political tour could have much or anything to do with the fortunes of little Anne Shirley at Green Gables. It was in January the premier came to address his loyal supporters and such of his non-supporters as chose to be present at the monster mass meeting held in Charlottetown. Most of the Avonlea people were on the premier's side of politics. Hence, on the night of the meeting, nearly all the men and a goodly proportion of the women had gone to town, 30 miles away. Mrs. Rachel Lynde had gone too. Mrs. Rachel Lynde was a red-hot politician and couldn't have believed that the political rally could be carried through without her, although she was on the opposite side of politics. So she went to town and took her husband, Thomas would be useful in looking after the horse, and Marilla Cuthbert with her. Marilla had a sneaking interest in politics herself, and as she thought it might be her only chance to see a real live premiere, she promptly took it, leaving Anne and Matthew to keep house until her return the following day. Hence, while Marilla and Mrs. Rachel were enjoying themselves hugely at the mass meeting, Anne and Matthew had the cheerful kitchen at Green Gables all to themselves. Montgomery did a really good job writing this passage because you don't have to understand anything about the particulars of Canadian politics at this time and place, but everything still makes sense. I tried to educate myself a little bit about Canadian politics in the 19th century, and wow, is it complicated. The nation of Canada was established in 1867, but before that it was a messy group of separate political chunks governed by men called premiers. But even after Canada was unified into a proper country, people continued to sometimes use the word premier to refer to the prime minister. Montgomery doesn't name the premier exactly, but most readers over the years have taken this passage to be about John A. Macdonald. He served as a regional premier before Canada's unification, and he was elected as the country's first prime minister in 1867. He was out of power for a few years before making a comeback in 1878, and he stayed in office until he died in 1891. In the 1880s, he was at the height of his power and would have been a hugely important figure in the minds of most average Canadian citizens. This passage is really short, but it tells us a lot about the politics of the period. First, we learn that political rallies were just as popular in the 19th century as they are today. In fact, they might have even been more important because there was no radio, TV, or internet. You couldn't just switch on your electronic device and see what your favorite candidate or politician had said that day. If you ever wanted to see and hear a politician, you had to do it in person. This passage also shows that even though women didn't have voting rights, they were still very much engaged in the political process. It's a funny bit where Rachel Lynde is described as only bringing her husband along so he can look after the horse, but this shows that women could have very strong opinions and want to be involved in political discussions. We also see that Marilla was interested enough in politics to go to the rally, but Matthew wasn't, despite the fact that he could vote and she couldn't. Plenty of women in Avonlea had the interest and ability to go to this event, showing that both the men and the women on Prince Edward Island at this time in history respected the right of women to attend political events, be well informed, and have their own opinions. The women who didn't go would have had various reasons for staying home. Some would be old, ill, pregnant, recovering from pregnancy, taking care of young children, or just too busy to go. There would, of course, been some women who were forbidden from going by domineering husbands, but from the description that Montgomery gives here, it would seem that meek, beaten-down wives barred from any kind of public life were not that common. We also see that this is an event where people with differing political opinions were able to mix and still have a wonderful time together. Marilla and most of the Avonlea folk supported the Conservative Party, to which this visiting premier belongs, and which favored center-right policies. Rachel Lynde attends the rally despite being a member of the Grit Party, the forerunner of the modern Labour Party, which back then favored modestly progressive social and political reforms. Back home at Green Gables, Anne is showing that she's starting to discover the world beyond friends, school, church, and neighborhood. But she's also just sort of reflecting and absorbing the opinions that she's heard adults around her express. I wonder how Marilla and Mrs. Lynde are enjoying themselves. Mrs. Lynde says Canada is going to the dogs the way things are being run at Ottawa, and that it's an awful warning to the electors. She says if women were allowed to vote, we would soon see a blessed change. What way do you vote, Matthew?
Conservative, said Matthew promptly.
To vote conservative was part of Matthew's religion. Then I'm a conservative too, said Anne decidedly. I'm glad because some of the boys in school are grits. I guess Mr. Phillips is a grit too, because Prissy Andrews's father is one, and Ruby Gillis says that when a man is courtin', he always has to agree with the girl's mother in religion and her father in politics. Is that true, Matthew?
Well, now I don't know, said Matthew.
Did you ever go courting, Matthew?
Well, now, no, I dunno's I ever did, said Matthew,
who had certainly never thought of such a thing in his whole existence. Even though it's set long ago and far away, it's striking how familiar this scene is. Anne is too young to really have any real understanding of politics or government policy. She very innocently idealizes Matthew and wants to be like him, so it's natural for her to join his political tribe. Add in the fact that Anne's archenemy and future husband, Gilbert, is a grit, and it's easy to see why she leans conservative. We also see that Montgomery slips in the idea of votes for women, again through the voice of Rachel Lynde. Anne Shirley would have been born in 1866, so this fictional character wouldn't have gotten the right to vote until she was 52 years old in 1918. Finding out that Gilbert is a grit explains a little bit of his character. At the time of the events of Anne of Green Gables, the grits were still working to expand voting rights to all men, rather than just white property owners over the age of 21.
As a party, they weren't pushing for votes for women. But it was the party that was interested in expanding the right to vote, and it's the one that the suffragettes made the most progress with. In all the novels about Anne Shirley, Gilbert Blythe never questions Anne's intelligence or her rights and abilities when it comes to gaining as much education and career experience as she can. They become the two top students in school, and Gilbert never treats Anne as less than equal. In fact, he's so supportive of Anne's progress that later on he gives up a job offer to teach at the Avonlea school so that she can have the position. He takes a job in another town so that Anne can remain at Green Gables with Marilla, who's growing frail as she suffers from debilitating headaches and increasing blindness. Gilbert's in love with Anne, certainly, but he remains entirely supportive of her as she works, attends university, and earns a degree, something that very few women did in this period and which most men would not have supported. So even though this quick mention of Gilbert's political affiliation is done for a bit of humor, it also gives us a lot of insight into his personal and social philosophy. There are a couple of other casual mentions of politics in the story, mostly done for laughs. In chapter 30, Mrs. Lynde discourages a local boy from going into politics because, as an honest person, he's not enough of a rascal to succeed. This kind of joke is still told today and probably always will be. In chapter 32, Anne takes her college entrance exams, and it takes quite a while for the results to come back. Mrs. Lynde blames the superintendent of education, who's a conservative. It's the kind of natural, casual comments that people just made back then and to this day, in which we claim that if our party could just get into power, everything would be perfect. I have one more installment in my series on Anne of Green Gables as a work of historical fiction. Next time we'll talk about the role of religion in this story and how it reflects the sort of discussions that were happening in the 19th century. I hope our little foray into old-timey Canadian politics encourages you to have discussions with your own kids about the bigger world beyond home, school, and friends. You can use these passages from Anne of Green Gables to start discussions about why people have such different feelings about how the world should be run, and why those differences don't have to drive us apart. Because whether we live on a tiny island or in a giant city, we'll all have to learn to get along together. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.